I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The pandemic wreaked havoc on schools in the last two-plus years with shutdowns and mandates, the challenges of remote learning, absenteeism, and illness. While the virus is still with us, schools are ready to open their doors to students for in-classroom learning. Here in Philadelphia, the spike in gun violence has had a disproportionate effect on young people. Helen Ubinas, who writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, said that since 2018, more than 700 of the shooting victims in the city have been under the age of 18. Philadelphia is the poorest big city in the country, which can have a profound effect on children's development and well-being. Well, we've convened a roundtable of teachers to find out about their plans for the new school year, how they have coped with the stresses and disruptions of COVID, their hopes and dreams and expectations for their students. And let me introduce them to you. Estefana Ramos is a teacher at Vare Washington Elementary School. She'll be teaching kindergarten this year. Estefana, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Super pumped to be here.
Super pumped to have you. Samuel Reed is with us as well. He's a teacher and founder at the U School, where he teaches African American history, math, and personal finance. Reed, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us. And rounding out our trio of guests is Andrew Saltz. He's an English and computer science teacher at Paul Robeson High School. And Andrew, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We made it to the big time.
Yeah, I'm glad you feel that way. Let me just make sure that the other teachers in our audience can join our conversation. We're going to be talking about and with teachers, so we want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You know, I was thinking after two plus grueling, chaotic years, you know, how a teacher prepares for the next school year. And perhaps, Estefana, I can start with you. How are you preparing for what's ahead, knowing that, you know, stuff can happen, right?
Yeah, it's funny because I've only taught in Philadelphia for 3 years, and this is going to be my fourth year. And every single year that I've been here, preparation has looked different. This is going to be the first year that I've been here where I am in the same school, expecting to come back in person, and I'm trying not to use the word normal, right?
Yeah,
I'm trying not to use the word
normal.
You have
to be careful
with that. Yeah. But we're going to be in person, and yeah, it's going to be more similar to what it was pre-pandemic, even though we continue to be in the scope of pandemic life, right?
Right, but have learned hopefully better to live with it. How about for you, Reed? How are you preparing? And you've been teaching for 20-some years.
Yeah, no. I rely on my networks, and so I'm feeling prepared, and the power of networks has been the thing that helped sustain me as well during the pandemic. I belong with this group, a research group. We're studying digital discourse and ways of engaging young folks with digital tools and technology, but not just the technology, but how do we engage kids in discourse in general? And so the networks has been the thing that sustained me, and it's the thing that's made me feel like I'm ready to enter into the classroom, come what may.
And knowing that you've got this team around you, how about for you, Andrew?
Well, first and foremost, I'm excited. You know, you have, I think what was said before is that you have a little expectation of what's to come, even if you're not entirely sure. You know, Omicron really did a number, and I think a lot of us are feeling we're not quite sure what the future looks like. And it's hard to prepare when you don't know how many teachers are going to be in and out, how many students are going to be in and out, and what other challenges face. I don't know if you remember, but last fall, when the Vine Street Expressway flooded, we lost a day of school for that. You know, so we got climate change, politics, and gun violence. It's hard to plan ahead with all that, but I'm going through my usual routine. I'm getting my sleep cycle back. I'm prepping my meals. I got
it's
my
a marathon. Though,
I got my anxiety dreams. I'm getting excited and thinking about cool stuff I could do. So I'm going through my regular checklist with the back of my mind being, I don't know.
Well, it's funny you said anxiety dreams because I was looking at your Twitter account, Andrew, and you did talk about that. And I think there are anxiety dreams that go with being professional. I have them as well. Do you have them?
Oh, my gosh.
Estefana?
I think at the end of the school year, I had them for 2 weeks into the summer. I haven't quite started having them again yet. And I will say, I have a great support system, as Reed said, at my school. We're all at different places in our career, though, right? So I think that it's important to note, teachers, we're all still on vacation. We don't go back till Tuesday. But at the same time, because we're all at different levels in our careers, different places, you know, we're all there's a lot of neurodiversity in the teaching field, right? We're people. Some people want to go in early and get things going, but guess what? We're not getting paid for that right now. Some people can't go in because their schools are being rewired or covered in dust or whatever it might be, right? So it takes a village, and I'm sure the dreams will come back soon.
Well, let me talk about teaching, and I'll put this to you, Andrew. And you know, I cannot imagine either being a teacher or a student during the pandemic, especially, let's say, you teach young children, doing that remotely. I mean, there just had to have been so much that was, you had to figure out how to do a workaround, because so much of teaching and learning is about relationships and hands-on experiences.
Yeah, I want to push back a little bit around this concept of what's going around, like learning loss, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Like, kids learned during the pandemic, they learned without pandemic, and some of the things that they learned was how to pivot and how to, like, rely on their resiliency, their wit. And then as an educator, I'm using the tools that were before me. And for me, it was like, it was kind of a cool opportunity, because we were able to do, like, one thing to deal with anxiety was that we were able to do mindfulness in the virtual realm, that, like, because in the real space, when we're doing our mindfulness, kids are looking at each other, and they might not want to, like, really get into that.
And you're talking about mindfulness.
Yeah, I mean, mindfulness is a practice, right?
Yes, exactly.
So we built up those muscles, and then when we came back to school, now it was less like I have to, like, put on a face that this mindfulness thing isn't a good thing, because, like, kids really, really lean into the mindfulness because they knew they needed it as well, because they were coming in with all this anxiety and all of these things. And then parents, the other thing that the pandemic offered for us was, like, a window into our classroom. So, again, teachers that were really doing their job, like, the parents were really seeing it, and they were really feeling connected, and they were I was really, really felt more connected to my parents than when we went back to school. They recalled, oh, yeah, Reed, he did the mindfulness thing. He played the music. He did the transitions. Like, they saw that I was doing my job, and that felt good for me. Mm-hmm. Well, I love that transparency.
And when you said, Reed, talking about, you know, questioning learning loss, both of you, Andrew, both of you, Estefanus, nodded vigorously. Is that overplayed?
I think Sam spoke really well that there were really innovative things we could have done with virtual school and translated over. Unfortunately, a lot of them didn't. But I just want to say, we lose some 2.5 weeks every year to standardized testing. We lose to environmental concerns. This is my school's first year with air conditioning. But before that, if it was over 90, 95 degrees, a parent with a child with asthma is not coming into the school, nor should they. We lose it to when parents are working and a child is sick. I'm in high school. The older child takes care of the younger child. All that learning loss was just the background noise. And then all of a sudden, COVID comes along, and it's, oh, well, they're missing all these days. What's going on? And I'm sitting there like, where have you been? And I don't want to minimize anyone's hurt or pain, especially the younger kids. I have a younger kid who needed it. But it really does irk me when people say, wow, they'll never recover from this learning loss, when you have kids who have to stay home because they're afraid to come to school because we can't keep the streets safe.
Well, and you work with younger kids.
Absolutely. I want to speak a little bit to what Reed was saying about mindfulness and the practice of it in virtual, and then moving later into the actual classroom too, because that virtual also became a bit of a scaffold too that we were able to remove once we got back to the classroom, right? And then speaking to the idea of learning loss that we're working on pushing against. Absolutely. Something that you said, Andrew, about how we have these children that come in, but then there are interruptions in their education generally in everyday normal life, right? And that also comes to when you're thinking about the intersections of children and where they and their families are, whether it be class or race or where neighborhood. I think that children then are, like what Reed said, developing these skills that we don't actually acknowledge, right? So, like, so this is my first year back in kindergarten in like 10 years.
Yeah.
Before, during the pandemic, I was teaching in second grade. And once we came back into hybrid and in person, I remember telling myself, you have to pump them up about the amount of digital literacy that they have in comparison to any other second graders that have stepped foot in this classroom before. And even the emergent readers, the kiddos that don't know their letter names and sounds yet in second grade, have digital literacy, know how to type in www dot, or know how to mute themselves. I mean, it took a long time. It took a lot of work, right?
Sure.
But these are things that we can't forget that they took. These are foundational skills that we built maybe before their standardized testing, standards-based skills that we are held to, right? So I don't remember why I started talking, but yes, that is.
Well, we were talking about, I don't want to say it's the myth, because I think, I mean, I mean, some kids, obviously, it was a struggle. I mean, some kids didn't have access to the internet, right, Reed?
Yeah, some kids, but the district did their best to try to mitigate that with, I guess, support from some corporate, you know, sponsors or whatever.
Well,
the
and from
be.
The community. You talked a lot about your network, Reed. Uh-huh. And and one at my school at Vere Washington, Meredith Boos, Adina Goldstein, so many of us in our school, parents and teachers came together and said, there's kids we can't find right now. Mm-hmm. They're not logging in. We went on the ground and drove around looking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if y'all remember, this feels so long ago, it wasn't, that we didn't have anything to do for 2 weeks. We just sat there twiddling our fingers, worrying about our families and then about our Philly communities, right? And so, yeah, we started raising money. We started we had Eric Young go out to all of these schools or all of these children's homes based on attendance, login attendance, and help them connect to the internet. I mean, with the support of the district and their partnerships with different companies. But yeah, like that wouldn't have happened without the on the ground work that teachers and community members did.
And it was bad, right? Nobody thinks the pandemic was good. Nobody's happy the way this worked out. And if it was up to me, we keep everything closed except the schools. Because if schools are that important, we can close down businesses, keep those people in their house, and get the schools in. They didn't choose to do that. And I understand there are people who suffered and there are kids who lost. I just think it's fair to question that the learning loss that was going on in certain communities for decades – Marty, you're doing a great job. There weren't a lot of radio shows on that. There weren't Atlantic articles being written on that one. And that's something we should think about.
No, absolutely. And we do need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Andrew Saltz. He's an English and computer science teacher at Paul Robeson High School. Samuel Reed is a teacher founder at the U School, where he teaches African American history, math, and personal finance. And Estefana Ramos is a teacher at Vere Washington Elementary School. She's teaching kindergarten this year. They are all Philadelphia teachers talking about what it is to teach in 2022. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we've convened a roundtable of Philadelphia teachers to talk about their plans, their hopes and dreams for the new academic year. Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Nellie came right up just as we began the show. She says, I cannot say this enough. Thank you. What do Philadelphians without kids in our schools need to know and do to support you? She also asks, what qualities and actions are you and your colleagues looking for in Philadelphia's next mayor? Well, how about, you have a new superintendent, so let's start there. And perhaps Rita, I'll go to you in terms of what advice would you give, you know, the new superintendent who, you know, follows Superintendent Hyde, who was here about 10 years.
I'm going to take a deep breath first.
Go ahead. Use that mindfulness stuff,
I'm
going to
use the mindfulness first. And honestly, you know, the new superintendent is coming in with a clean slate, clean opportunity. I think he did a good job in terms of, like, building up a network. Mm-hmm. You know, he's called on a bunch of folks to advise him. And there's this book that I recently read, and I did a review on, Not Paid For Us, by Dr. Kamika Royal, that mm-hmm. basically talks about my whole trajectory as a student in Philadelphia, because I went to Philly Public Schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I graduated from Philly Public Schools, and now I've educated, and my own students have gone through Philly schools. Like, read that book again, and, like, take lots of notes.
And his name is Tony Watlington. He's actually going to be a guest next week on Radio Times. Do you have advice for him?
Well, I would say, I don't know if it's too late for this, but be able to make mistakes and correct course. You know, the old administration would do some things, and there would be mistakes. But they would never admit a mistake. There would always, it was always, this was what we meant to do. This is about equity. We're going to keep moving. And then the kids at SLA Bieber were supposed to go into Porta John's at the beginning of last year because they didn't have the bathrooms ready. The man's already hired a friend of his at a significant $450,000 salary. You know, that doesn't seem like the best foot to get off in. And it concerns me that he's there to have the superintendent's back. And they're there to, you know, keep the wagon circled, to make sure everything is good. And you got to be able to make mistakes. You got to hold people accountable if we're going to move forward.
Right. And you're clearly watching. How about for you, Estefana?
I think that I would just say, I mean, it's hard not to listen to teachers because there's a lot of us. But but actually hear us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, don't be intimidated by the mass of teachers. Hear us, listen to us, think about what it's actually like in the classroom. If you have to time travel and put your brain back in that day when you mm-hmm. spent the most time in the classroom, do that when you're making decisions.
Yeah. And I'm also a parent in the district.
This is Andrew.
And
it's
Andrew. Hi. It's okay. And one thing I would say is, like, what is the experience like for parents right now? Last year, they moved bus start times in elementary school till 9 a.m. If you're a working parent, that's not going to work. There was no before care offered. You know, just what is the experience like for parents, and how can I improve that? Ignore the test scores. Ignore all that. Just walking into a school trying to get things done. Because there are a lot of parents who are trying to get things done for public schools, and at some point you get tired of ramming your head into that wall.
Let me shift gears. And Reed, I'll start with you. Mm-hmm. How do you create an environment? And you've been teaching a long time, as have you, Andrew, and frankly, as have you, Estefana. So anyway, you're all veteran teachers. How do you create that environment in a classroom so that when the children walk in for the, you know, their very first day of school, and they want to be there, they want to know you, they want to do their work, they want to find themselves. How do you create that?
Yeah, it's all about, like, creating trust, right? But you create trust through time, and you don't rush it, and you don't, like, make kids become too vulnerable at early stages, because sometimes, like, oh, tell me something about your, you know, like, what did you do for the summer?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's not the right question because you don't know. So, like, listen. Become a more proactive listener. Become like a coach. And so the main thing is, like, lean in with empathy with your kids and develop that trust. Once you develop the trust, then it opens. They're going to come to you. They're going to share. They're going to be willing to become more vulnerable. And that means that you yourself also have to become vulnerable, right? Sometimes it's like, oh, don't smile until, you know, December. Like, oh, you're human. Smile. If a kid says
something
funny. I didn't
know there
funny,
was such a thing. But, yeah, I hear you. And again, a lot of nodding in the room here.
Oh, my God, did I get that?
Yeah.
And, oh, my God, is it wrong?
If a kid says something funny, like, you have to laugh. Because it's funny. Uh-huh.
And you're laughing.
Yeah, because that is, like, the thing you hear the most when you start teaching.
Like, don't.
Don't smile. Don't be human until after Thanksgiving break. Or right?
Mm-hmm. Because this is all about law and order?
It's about that, and it's about... I think it comes from a time when vulnerability wasn't seen as a strength, right? So leadership doesn't need to show vulnerability because leadership needs to seem in control all the time. Mm. So, like, kind of what Reed said about, like, making sure that if you need to smile, smile, like being human with these students and giving them a space to be vulnerable before requiring them to disclose anything that might be uncomfortable, right? And for elementary, for early elementary and young children, I think the thing that really makes a classroom environment is, in my experience, simultaneously feeling big feelings with them, mm-hmm. And knowing when and how to facilitate those feelings with their guidance.
Sure.
So if it's time to calm down, helping them learn how to do that, self-regulation, all those kinds of things. That's
big feelings. I mean, I like that. I think that's a good way to think. Andrew, looks like you want to add something.
Well,
about smiling. I would say
even more. kindness is not weakness, right? Grace, giving people kindness and second chances and third chances and fifth chances, even when they might not deserve it. That's not something you have to earn. That's something you get. And if a kid comes in knowing they can make a mistake, then they're much more likely to give you their best, because I think what Sam said, you're treating them like a human being. And kindness, like any other emotion, is infectious. And so I think coming in, showing kindness, showing grace, understanding what we're all going through, all of us adults too, especially at the high school level, and that we're here to help each other. Kindness.
Yeah.
Can I add one more point? Also, like, celebrating the failures, and then you making the mea culpa, is like, yo, I screwed up as mm-hmm. well, and like acknowledging that, crazy capital. Yeah. Like, yo, I screwed up yesterday. I went off on y'all, and I was wrong, right?
Own it. Apologize. Explain.
That whole restorative process. Crazy capital. You know, for you and your students in the community that you're building. Because you're building a community. Mm-hmm. And, like, you're going to make mistakes. But when we make mistakes, like, oh, man, that was awesome. That was an epic failure. Like, yo, I celebrate that failure. Mm. Now, what can we learn from it? And let's move on.
Let me quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Samuel Reed. He's a teacher founder at the U School, and again, teaches African American history, math, and personal finance. Estefana Ramos is a teacher at Vare Washington Elementary School, where she will be teaching kindergarten this year. And Andrew Saltz is an English and computer science teacher at Paul Robeson High School. All of them Philadelphia teachers, all of them talking about how to create an environment of learning and vulnerability and be able to make mistakes, as we all do, and their hopes, of course, and expectations and dreams for their students. And again, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @whyyradiotimes, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I mentioned gun violence in my introduction, and as we all know, in Philadelphia, it's been just a year of just the most frightening and worrisome level of spike in gun violence. And we know that so many young people either witness it, or they know someone who has been killed or injured, or they have some personal experience with that. And I'll start with you, Andrew, which is, how do you help? I don't know if that's a true assumption or not, but you're saying yes, it is. I mean, this is absolutely true. Go ahead.
We had I think two students shot last year. Wow. They both survived, thank goodness. But we had one 2 years ago, David, who did not make it. So part of it is going through it as a community. But I think it was what I said earlier. It's true at kindergarten. It's true at the upper levels too. Is giving people space for big emotions, and sometimes emotions that you may not feel are appropriate, but that's what they're feeling, and they don't feel comfortable expressing it otherwise. But just giving people space for that, and grace, the understanding that the way we handle it isn't different, and a constant hand where if you can't handle this yourself, and by the way, most of us can't, there are people here who can help you.
Right.
And hopefully it's not me, because I mean, I'm here to talk to a kid and understand it, but too many teachers become counselors or social workers when we need to hire counselors or social workers. Professionals.
And you said, oh, yes, Estefana. I mean, we need more counselors.
Absolutely. I don't have the same experience as an early elementary educator, but my kids are still witnessing all of it, right? Because they're Philadelphians.
Sure.
And, you know, they don't express themselves in the same ways. with the same eloquence that older students do to reflect the things that they've experienced. And so I don't always know exactly. You have to do it indirectly sometimes at the lower levels because you can't just be like,
well, how are you feeling
today?
How
are you feeling? I heard you had a family member that got hurt. And like, or did you? You can't. There's no. You have to stop yourself from making assumptions. You have to stop yourself from forcing information that you don't own. And you have to just understand that everybody here is witness to this in different capacities and give space for them to experience that in the way that they're experiencing it.
I mean, listen, right? I mean, Reed, that's you've said that word a bunch of times.
Yeah, and then also, like, find ways to advocate and activate as a response to the violence, right? Instead of, like, oh, woe is me and giving up, right? And, I mean, we lost, during the peak of the pandemic, we lost a student to gun violence, Muhammad. And I remember Muhammad in my classroom in history class, and for the most part, you know, school was boring to him, so his head was down most of all the time, except when I talked about money and economics, finance, his head would pop up, right? Uh-huh. And when he passed away, and we were, like, healing as a school community, and I was healing personally myself, I'm like, man, like, what can I do to, like, engage, you know, the Muhammads of the world? And so I started this, like, business 101 side hustle accelerator, partly inspired by Muhammad and wanting to engage him, young folks and not so young folks, in like starting up small businesses and the like. And so that's like a legacy that's going on. You know, I don't call it the Muhammad program, but it was inspired.
But when you talked that way, you saw him and then at lift the same his head, literally.
Yeah, and at the same time, we had the gun violence going on. We had the pandemic going on. It was like all of these things, and I could have like, oh, well, it's me. But I'm like, okay, let me lean in and let me try to do something. And I wasn't going to go out in the streets because I'm a different age now. I'm like, I'm not going out in the streets, but I'm going to do something different that could have some kind of lasting impact.
I hate to even raise this, but I mean, this happened as a in response. I heard from some people what happened in Uvalde, Texas. You know, it's like now we need to arm teachers, and that's the way we're going to protect these students. And I mean, you are looking at me with horror.
I don't know where my. You can ask my students. By the way, shout out to all my Husky family. I miss you guys. I'm excited to see you. I don't know where my keys are. I put my coffee cup down. I walk away. I'm like, where's my coffee? They know they have to find it. Otherwise, I'm going to be in a bad mood. I am not the most organized human being in my classroom, and I work hard on it. For me, and you want to give me a gun?
Yeah.
Like you're yeah. I cannot. It takes a certain type to really teach in Philadelphia with what we have to go through and dealing with the stress. You don't want those people. You don't want those people armed. And honestly, you know, when we have this gun violence, how do you deal with kids who may feel threatened and feel they need to bring protection with them on the school? And the answer is, the best answer we've done is we have an amnesty box that our school officer put out there. And anything you put in the amnesty box, we don't ask anything about.
Oh, wow.
And when kids know they trust you, you're not there to rat them out. You're not there to put them into the system. You're just trying to keep people safe. All of a sudden, everything is an amnesty box because they'll tell you, hey, so-and-so's going through this. Keep an eye on them. Right? And if they know you're going to keep an eye on them to keep them safe and not incarcerate them, that's a way we keep each other safe. We don't rely on other people. We don't rely on guns. We keep each other safe.
And is right. I mean, and the amnesty box is
I can tell stories of what the officer can Officer Vall shout to Officer Vall can tell stories about what's found in there. But you know, it's this it's grace. It's a second chance. We know what's going on out there. We know you're going to make a mistake. Don't make a little mistake a big mistake.
Do you worry about your children going to and from school?
I do. I love this idea of an amnesty box. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily look the same at the elementary and middle school, but I'm wondering if it's something that could be implemented for families even, right? Like, keep an eye on my kid.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want to put my name on this because I don't want, you know, we're like we talked about earlier, mistakes, right? And everybody's so afraid of showing their mistakes, especially I feel like for me in my experience as a kid when I was growing up, I didn't want my classmates to know anything about my family's mistakes or my mistakes, mm-hmm. right? So if we have a place where we can put our put some of the mistakes that we're living amongst, like they're not even necessarily ours, right? Like we live in a world. That's just another brave, safe option. And so I think that, yeah, I absolutely worry about my kids. But I trust in the community. And I think that we could even take that further.
Yeah.
And I,
and the community watching out for,
absolutely.
For young people. Mm-hmm. How about for you, Reed?
Yeah. Like our school, the U school, is an open enrollment school. I like to say that we're a neighborhood school that's not attached to our neighborhood. So our kids travel from all over. And you can see here, I got my SEPTA pass.
You do. Your key. Yeah, I see it.
My SEPTA key. Because I'm a big supporter of public transit. Mm-hmm. But our kids don't want to ride the bus now. Mm-mm.
They're afraid?
Particularly the young men. Mm-hmm. They don't want to get on the bus. And so, and I hear them, but I'm like, how do we make, you know, public transportation seem more safe, you know, for young folks? Mm-hmm. And part of... Yeah, so.
I mean, we're almost up in a break here, but if you're afraid, it's hard to learn, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's troubling.
But also, if you're hungry, if you don't know where your food's come from, if you're worried about paying the light bill, if you're worried about paying the phone bill, if you don't know if your grandma's going to be okay. You know, we had a kid at our school. Dr. Ayla Stanford came to our school from the Black Doctors COVID Consortium. Yeah. She was amazing.
She is.
But she asked the kids. One kid said he lost 4 family members from COVID.
Oh, gosh.
So there. I would agree, absolutely, the violence. But, you know, when people's basic needs aren't met, it's really hard. It's really hard to learn.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with 3 Philadelphia teachers. That's Andrew Saltz, and again, he's an English teacher, also teaches computer science at Paul Robeson High School. Samuel Reed is a teacher founder at the U School, where he teaches African-American history, math, and personal finance. And Estefana Ramos is a teacher at Vare Washington Elementary School. She's taught in the elementary grades and will be teaching kindergarten this year. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you, especially the teachers in our audience. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with 3 teachers about teaching. Let me read a comment from Mike. He says, I find that kids coming into the trades, do apprenticeships, really aren't prepared. For example, some haven't been able to use a ruler correctly. I blame it on the administration that isn't giving the teachers the support that they need to teach kids. Anyone want to respond to that? Reed?
Andrew and I, we were talking about the need to like beef up CTE, which is career technical education programming in the district. And like at the U School, we've recently started our urban agricultural career technical education program.
Wow.
Training kids up for the jobs in, you know, sustainability, solar technology and the like. And yeah, we need to beef up those opportunities. Cause again, all kids aren't going to college as well. Right. And develop kids' entrepreneurial, you know, mindset and dispositions, right? So all those things are important, and the support and resources to do that.
Yeah,
bring them with us.
What made you want to be a teacher, Stefana?
Wow. Well, I think that I really just like people. And I love kids more than grown-ups. No offense, y'all. But then also, like, I was telling everybody during the break, I'm from Texas. I grew up in Amarillo, Texas, and I went to a small public school district on the outskirts, out of the city limits, as we call it in Texas. And I was one of the few Latina or Latinx students in my district there during the 90s, in the early 90s. There's a lot more now, but I never saw a teacher that looked like me. Even my Spanish teachers were always white. And I didn't think about it when I was a kid. I just kind of thought that's how it was, right? I don't think I saw a teacher of color until I transferred from the community college to University of Texas at Austin, and started seeing people from Central America, people mm-hmm. from Mexico, people from all over the world with advanced degrees teaching me. And then I thought, wow, wouldn't it have been cool? And I started meeting people who went to schools in cities, and they had teachers of a wide variety of backgrounds and experiences. And I thought, whoa, that would have been so cool. That would have been so cool. And I just kind of decided that I wanted to be that. I wanted to be a reflection to some kids. And then also, like, my name is Estefana, but I did not grow up speaking Spanish. I grew up hearing it. But I often there were a lot of assumptions made about me that I could speak it, and I couldn't. So I forced myself in college to learn it so that I could get to that point. And so now I feel like, okay, this is actually a form of capital that I have to use to help with families like my parents' family. When they were growing up, they didn't have teachers at school that they could talk to. I want to be able to reach as many family members and be a reflection.
Yeah, how about for you, Andrew?
Oh, I don't have this is a tough one to follow. I looked, and I was done with school. I looked at my resume and what was the job I liked the most, and it was being a soccer referee. For little kids, you know, like teaching them how to throw the ball without moving their feet. It was working at my synagogue. Shout out to Beth David fam. I was working there as an assistant teacher, you know. I don't even know that much. I was just there. I love just, you know, teaching. And then when I got to work in Philly schools, I realized how much I like learning. And you learn so much from the kids. The kids are able to, the families, you learn so much. And there is variety and there is energy, and I don't sit that much. And, you know, in the good days, I don't look at a screen that much. And you have a lot of emotional labor, but it's labor. And I feel good. I like doing it. I feel good doing it. I'm fortunate to be in a wonderful school. And I never look back.
Oh, that's nice. How about, what's your origin story, Ray?
Yeah. So my origin story, prior to becoming an educator, I was an entrepreneur. But prior to that, I got my MBA in business, and I wanted to go in business for myself out of graduate school, but I didn't have enough social capital or real capital, so I joined the Peace Corps.
You went to Botswana, right?
Yeah, I went to Botswana. Yeah. I joined the Peace Corps, started a business. My business went bankrupt, and my wife was like, my wife's from Botswana. My kids are all born in Africa. My wife's born in Africa in Botswana. She's like, Sam, you have to go back home. Uh-huh. And so we go back home, and there's this program, the Peace Corps Fellows Program at Temple, that allowed me to get my teacher certification. Because I was thinking about maybe doing a PhD in business, but I'm like, I want to do something that's not chasing money, but that's impactful. And so education was a solid choice, and I haven't looked back since.
I mean, those are three terrific stories, and so different, and obviously reflective of your three lives. Here's an email from Madeline who says, can your guests talk about the efforts by politicians to interfere in the curricula, references Florida about LGBTQ issues and Black history. I guess I'll go back to you, Andrew. Has that been an issue here in Philadelphia?
I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to echo these people, but like, come and take them. Like, we're going to teach, you know, we're going to teach Black history. We're going to teach about the way race affects people. We're going to make sure our classrooms are welcoming places for people of all genders and sexualities and kids who aren't quite sure where they are yet and adults who aren't quite sure where they are yet. And we're going to talk about the big issues. It's been fortunate we haven't had to deal with it, but also I'll speak for myself. And I think for a lot of other teachers, like, we're going to.
You're gonna,
yeah.
We're gonna. You're nodding your head.
I'm nodding. I also want to just give a shout out to the school district, particularly Ishmael Jimenez, who mm-hmm. has been like in the forefront of promoting African American, Latin American, LGBTQ, like all of that, Black Lives Matter, yes. And he's been unapologetic about like developing curricula and resources, mm-hmm. and then empowering teachers to do that as well.
Ish is great.
Yeah, that's good. Anything you want to add to that, Estefan?
Yeah, I think then also I want to acknowledge that it's not necessarily – I don't know that it's necessarily a general consensus within teaching, because we're mm-hmm. a very diverse field, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And yes. Where I teach right now is in South Philly, so there are lots of different varying opinions mm-hmm. on these things. So it can be very difficult to rally a school behind – some of what some of us consider to be very basic human rights of sexuality and gender and racial and class and all of these things, right? So it's been kind of difficult for me. I don't remember what the statistic is in the school district of Philadelphia, but it's different than where I come from in Oakland, where I taught for the last 6 years. The diversity of the teaching force here is not to the same level. Yeah. It's mostly white women. And the school where I teach right now is gradually diversifying little by little, but it feels different. It feels different to be a woman of color or a queer teacher, or it feels different. So I don't feel comfortable necessarily speaking on what I hope for my school so publicly because and I don't know that all of our community feels comfortable.
Yeah, let me just piggyback because I think that I mean the point about the diversity of the teacher force is absolutely critical. But with the parents, they don't all agree with the things we teach and the things we do. But a lot of people in Philly are fighting for survival, right? They need their kid to get through that. Mm-hmm. And so if you know, like, look, we can disagree on this, but these are the rules. I'm going to enforce them fairly, and my job is to help your kid. I care. I love your kid, and I want him to get through. People are willing to set that aside, I think, in communities where, like, you know, the basic needs are there, and then they got to fight over something because they're not fighting for survival. All of a sudden, these little things – these things that shouldn't be issues become mountains instead of molehills.
Let me pick up on something because I know there's an effort to get more black teachers in the district and probably Latino teachers as well. I think that the teacher workforce, I was doing a little research on this, Reed, is something like almost 24% of the teacher workforce is African American. I think half the students. Is that enough? I mean, how do you address the need for having, as you were describing, Stefano, wanting teachers that look like yourself.
Right? Yep. So, yeah, part of it is like attracting a diverse teacher, attracting black teachers, and then also keeping them. Before I was teaching at the U School, I taught at a middle school, the Bieber Middle School, which is now no longer. Shout out to Bieber Middle School. But a black male teaching force we took up the whole step of the school. We're like black male teachers. We just took our picture and like I saved that picture for memorial. Like when I left Bieber, you know, we were on just one step. Mm-hmm. And part of it was like we weren't replacing the black teachers that were leaving, that were retiring. And then also we had some long-term subs and that were transitioning to get their certification, and things were like there were some problematic. So, like roads to entry into the profession, we need to relook at those.
Yeah, I mean agreement around the table here, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I think also then I don't feel like people are proud of teachers. I feel like it's not like.
Yeah, we got to bring some. Sorry to cut you off, but yeah, we need to bring the swag back into the profession.
Right. Like
and
nobody.
That's the thing I love that's happening in some spaces.
My kids, I feel like you know, in early elementary, there are a lot of girls, a lot of kids, girls usually who did you know they just love me and they love their teacher, but they want to be teachers too, mm-hmm. and that's exciting to hear. But it's also just like, ooh, I don't know if I want you to be a teacher, right? Or like,
it's so hard.
It's a hard job, and it's not an easy job, and not hard as in like it's not doable. Hard as in that it will wreck you. It will you will get beat up in it. And I don't want my kids to get hurt. So and I want them to get, I want them to have prestige. I want them to feel like they can shine. And I think one of the reasons that I've been so smiley this whole time that we've been at this table is because we don't get to talk. Like I don't feel like I get heard a lot as a teacher by anybody other than my students and when we have some staff meetings.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So like I want my students to be able to use their voice and be heard.
And for you all to be respected and maybe paid more. I mean, we could go down that road too.
I think that would be important, but I mean this is an incident a long time ago, so I'm not getting anyone in trouble, but I know a teacher who at a young age, his brother died at the very beginning of the school year. A teacher, he took time off to deal with that bereavement. He took extra time, and the principal wrote him up for it, for dealing with the death of his brother in his 20s. And the kids see that, right? They see the way they are treated in some schools where the principals are told, like we said before, not to smile, to be the boss, to be the authority. Your teacher should be scared of you. And the kids see that and they say, why would I deal with this? I don't want to be in this school where they treat you like this. And now we have an economy where you have young men and women, non-white, as a white person, you know, non-white, and they say, well, I could be a teacher, or I watched my teachers get screamed at. We went through multiple principals. Each one had a different plan. They were always stressing. They were going bald. And I'm fortunate, Paul Robeson, I work in a nurturing environment, but I could see a kid saying, I could drive for Walmart, and I could make a similar starting salary, and there it is. Yeah. Who can blame him?
Did you want to add something, Reed?
No, go ahead.
It's all right. Okay, here's a tweet from, I think it's Gamal. It seems teachers spend lots of time and energy addressing the symptoms of social inequity. What do you recommend for strategies that lead to more students and staff arriving at school and flourishing? I mean, that's a big question. We've sort of talked about bits and pieces of that. But this issue of social inequity, Reed, you're living it, right, here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we're living it, but I think we need to, at the U School, we try to lean into this design thinking approach to, problem solving and, how can we solve the problem, or how do we see, how can we look at it as opportunities, and what are some things we can do? And that's been, part of my practice as an educator, or I like to call myself a teacherpreneur, is, finding opportunities and then leaning into those opportunities to find some solutions.
I'm watching the clock here. Estefano, what's a good day for you?
What's a good day for me?
Yeah, teaching. When the day's over and you say, that was a good day.
Yeah, I would say nobody cried. Nobody tattled. Or they came up to me, even better, they came up to me and said, Ms. Ramos, there's a problem at recess, but we fixed it. And then they tell me what happened. And then they use some of the language that we learned together on what it looks like to solve problems. Or they used resources around them, whether they be people or whatever, to help them solve a problem. That's so fun to watch little kids solve problems.
Yeah, that's – how about for you, Andrew?
Oh, man. Last year I had two students for a final project. They tried to start a vegan type not restaurant, but like make vegan food to see how they liked it, and they brought in some food and they had videos of the recipes, and they're like, we kind of like meat, this stuff isn't so good. but they had taken the learning upon themselves and they had applied it to something. They had learned about the thing, they had learned about the self themselves, and I think it is a very, from kindergarten all the way up to 11th grade, yeah, it's a similar thing. They are taking control of their own learning, and also it was really fun. And I think if you can walk away saying we helped them become better people, and also we had a really good time, and sometimes people cried, but that is expected. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't ask for more than that.
Yeah. 30 seconds for you, Reed. A good day.
A good day is when we have our exhibitions. I'm kind of piggybacking on that.
No.
Exhibitions at our school where kids get to acknowledge what they learned, or they even get to acknowledge, I mess up this quarter. I got to get it together. And just so that's a good day.
Well, look, it's really been a pleasure to meet all of you, have you on the radio talking about the important work you do. So thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go Huskies.
Go Huskies, whoever that is. No,
go U School.
Let me just make sure our listeners know who our guests have been. Stefana Ramos, again, teacher at Vair Washington Elementary School. She will be teaching kindergarten this year. Samuel Reed, teacher, founder at the U School. He teaches African American history, math, and personal finance. And Andrew Saltz, English and computer science teacher at Paul Robeson High School. You can find out more about Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.